Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 487th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a self-described oddball who has been in the business for more than 30 years, experiencing many personal and professional ups and downs along the way, but emerging a respected actress, writer, director, and producer with four Emmy nominations to her name. GQ once said of her, quote, "No one on television looks or sounds like her, with her raspy 1940s bartender voice, big curls, and New York-specific sense of cool. So distinct is her presence that it inevitably bleeds into her work on screen," close quote. Work that, in recent years, has included three notable comedy series. Netflix's Orange is the New Black, on which she appeared as Nikki, an addict incarcerated in a women's prison from 2013 through 2019. Netflix's Russian Doll, which she co-created with Amy Poehler and Leslie Headland, and on which she played Nadia, a woman caught in a time warp, in 2019 and 2022. And most recently, Peacock's Poker Face, the first season of which rolled out from January through March, with her starring as Charlie, a Vegas cocktail waitress who has the ability to tell when someone is lying, a part that Peter Travers, among others, has called the role of her career. Natasha Lyonne. Over the course of our conversation, the 44-year-old and I discussed her strange childhood and experience as a child actor, her rebellious spirit and addictive nature that resulted in drug use that sidelined her career for a number of years, the events of the past decade, during which she has made a remarkable comeback as an actress and also has increasingly ventured into writing, directing, and through Animal Pictures, a company she founded in 2018 with Maya Rudolph, producing, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to have you. And on this one, we always begin truly at the beginning. If you could just share for our listeners, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
Ah, Jesus Christ. This is like my nightmare from back in high school. This is like junior high. This is why I decided to become a self-made person. Because I wanted to avoid parents asking me questions like this about my crazy parents at dinner tables and then just to be ashamed when I had no reasonable answer. Hi, I'm Natasha Lyonne. Still, after all these years, my God, it's been a long run. Thanks for catching up. And where am I from? I'm from New York. I'm a real New Yorker. A lot of people think it's subtle. Often I had to turn down a lot of parts on The Crown, which was something that I didn't want to talk about today, but here we are.
You're very open. Thank you for being so honest.
No problem. And my parents, yeah, they were professional head cases, which gives you a lot of material to work with. You become an accidental expert on the human condition, as it were. Scat. I guess they were writing and acting coaches, and boy, the cinematic scenes that they could paint, listening to their crazy 60s music, walking around the house like lunatics with bottles of vodka. I mean, they would paint pictures and Tina Turner would be playing in the background full volume. They really gave me some images.
Well, okay, so this people should catch wind. You're going to joke a lot here, but one thing that is totally true, correct me, I'm from everything I've read, I would not have guessed in advance of prepping for this that you grew up partially in Israel. You were Orthodox. You went to yeshiva.
Whoa. Okay, no. Especially at a time like this, all right, with Kanye going willy-nilly every day, all right, he's in, he's out. Listen, let me explain something to you. First of all, I'm a nothing by choice. Okay. I'm not even utterly convinced that I or you exist in the first place. All right. I'm at best a surrealist, at worst a Satanist, or maybe vice versa. Next thing you know, these two nut jobs. So anyway, we were living in New York, and yes, they come from, on my mother's side, they're Holocaust survivors. My mother was born in Paris. My father's side, they're like fifth generation Brooklyn American. And, but like my grandfather served in World War II, like I, you know, and the American side, they're American people on my dad's side, Brooklyn. My parents are sort of the black sheep of these pretty traditional Jewish families. And by the time it gets to me, so I'm like in New York City, I'm already doing things like Pee-wee's Playhouse. I'm, you know, it's a wild household and big on boxing. Mike Tyson is the big hero of the family. Then, yes, tax evasion is the reason that we move to Israel. So I think a lot of people have misunderstood that over the years as some sort of Zionistic trip that nobody was involved in. It was quite simply tax evasion, Scott. And that's how we ended up selling this place and not paying and moving to Israel, where, yes, I guess it was no coincidence, their parents would help support them if they went somewhere with this fantasy. And very quickly, you know, my dad, he wanted to be the Don King of Israel and bring Mike Tyson to the Tel Aviv Hilton. That slowly fell apart. And my mother and I moved back to Manhattan. And I was a tween actor. And well, it's been a scholarship kid on the Upper East Side.
Yeah, no, look, I don't want to gloss over. So you mentioned even before Israel, which where were, how old were you when you were there? What was the age
range? I lived there between the ages of 8 to 10 only.
Okay, so already before that, you were doing, as you said, Pee-wee's Playhouse and some earlier, I think, commercials and modeling. How does that even begin?
I didn't prior to my modeling career, because I do feel like it doesn't. I think it might be that I obviously have some personality problems, and it really gets in the way of shining a light on, you know, because they say multi-hyphenate, and I feel like we talk about Russian Doll. It's like writing, directing, show running, but rarely are we talking about modeling. And
yeah, not just any modeling, Ford modeling, right? Ford modeling agency. This is a big deal.
Okay. Pretty baby.
Well, so I'm assuming if this is all going on before you're even 8, and I think you were on Pee-wee at 6, this, how much of it can it even be the kid's own idea? Was it your parents hoping for you to have a kind of showbiz career, or were you pushing for it?
Yes, I think that they're very sick individuals. They're dead, so I can speak freely. And also, I've recently quit smoking, so I've got nothing to live for. I'm really getting through each moment by hook and crook, skin of teeth, so on and so forth. This is some sort of a tea tree flavored toothpick. I don't know what it's for. It's doing nothing. And the way I know it's doing nothing is, you see, there's no smoke coming out of the toothpick. You see what I mean? And that's how I know it's a flawed objet.
I'm very impressed. I had no, when, did, how recently did you quit smoking?
It's been like 4 weeks now.
Good for you. That's amazing.
Is it good or is it the worst decision I've ever made? Anyway, so I don't know what these people were thinking. I think they wanted to be famous, which is why I've always had and still have a very, a warped relationship to the idea of fame for fame's sake. I don't understand it conceptually. I think it's a very sick and soul-sucking disease. I think it's a real mental problem that seems to have taken over the nation, if by social media is any evidence of that. You know, I really, of course, am obsessed with, real deal things and Cassavetes and Sidney Lumet and Nick Rogues and all my friends. I love, you know, the movies. I love the arts. I love literature and music and big thinking and philosophy and the suffering that comes with it. But I didn't understand. I didn't really choose it. I guess I had curly hair and so did Shirley Temple. And, I was witty and But I do think that obviously, and I'm sure we'll catch up to my drug run, so let's get there sooner than later. I think as a teenage dropout of this business, a lot of it for me was about sort of reaching the top of some kind of a showbiz mountain and seeing that there was no there there, and, you know, dropping out and saying, I'd like to go under now and see where Kerouac and Bukowski and all my other friends are. And sure enough, I found it almost like Jason Patrick in a movie called Narc. I was in too deep. And
Well, all right. So we got to pause here for a second, though, because you have all these incredible cinematic, literary references, all of that. But you had left school or were invited to leave school in high school, right? You then started at NYU Tisch at a very early age, left that. Were you totally self-educated with all of this stuff?
You know, a bit, I guess. Yeah, I really, really, really love the things I love. I would say I'm a bit of a nerd, basically. I just am like, you know, something of a encyclopedia around the things that interest me, and pretty much have little to no information in other areas. But when it came to whatever, you know, Hermann Hesse, or if I would watch Apocalypse Now, and then I would, you know, read Heart of Darkness, and then I would watch the documentary Hearts of Darkness that, you know, Coppola's wife made. And then I was 16. I was in early admission to Tisch in the film philosophy double major. And I was in the film program. I was like, I've done a decade of acting. I've started with Pee Wee Herman. I've ended with Woody Allen, a mm-hmm. name you don't hear often on the podcast these days. And so to me, that was like my decade of acting. And now I was going to read all this philosophy, and I was going to sort of, I don't know, Albert Brooks or Bergman or, you know, Woody or whatever style. I was going to kind of just infuse it into stuff, and maybe I was going to do it first person. Maybe I was going to be like a Harold Lloyd or a Charlie Chaplin, or I didn't know exactly what yet, but I knew I wanted to make movies physically, and I knew I wanted to make them with the information. And I bring up Bergman because, you know, you would see sort of like in The Seventh Seal or something, you could just give philosophical quotes and that was enough. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like Max von Sydow was there and that was enough. So I think I was like, oh, I guess this is how you write pictures. And, anyway, then, yeah, the kids there who were 18 had not seen Apocalypse Now and Cinema Studies 101. I got somewhat aggressive about that. I said, I cannot believe, I walked right to the dean of admissions office. I said, I can't believe you want $60,000 for me to sit with these kids. How have they never taken it on themselves to watch this movie? It just seems weird to me. Mm-hmm. I don't understand what's going on with them. I don't want to get to know them. And mm-hmm. So I kind of left and went to the film forum. I found an apartment in the back of the New York Times back when there was you'd open the paper. It was a little studio apartment. And I had the $60,000 from arguably a blackface picture, Krippendorf's Tribe, Disney release, Richard Dreyfuss, Lily Tomlin. It was supposedly going to be like a big movie. But anyway, I had this big, it was like $60,000 burning a hole in my pocket. And I was like, well, I can either go to school for a semester and play Apocalypse Now with these children, or I can buy this weird studio apartment and go to the film forum. And so that's what I did.
Nice. Well, and up to that point, I guess, you know, we should just talk about, you don't just jump, do you, from Pee Wee's Playhouse to movies? I think your first time in a movie was uncredited, but this is Heartburn in 86, right? This is for Mike Nichols, but really it seems like you and the Efrons became tight. Was that out of that?
Well, it was more of like a funny thing that, you know, when I reunited with, Nora Ephron and Delia Ephron, his sister, who I'm also so close with, it was like this wild thing to realize that that had been my very first gig. And I remember, you know, we were working on this play that they had written for a while. And at some point I was complaining. I had this boyfriend who was like a tour manager who was cheating on me. And, you know, musicians, Scott, it's just the way it goes, baby. And buy the ticket, take the ride. That's what they say. And so Nora, because I was always like coming in being like, I don't get it, you know, and then this scumbag said blank. And I was already a part of like her poker game, which is great. Bob Balaban is there. Nick Pileggi. It's heavy hitters. Very scary. And she
this
was
is
like,
back in the Heartburn era, or when was
I
don't this?
Know. This is in already like probably 2005, I guess.
Okay, so years and years later. Yeah, yeah.
Now doing this play called Love Lost and What I Wore Together.
Right.
Delia wrote. And but every day I'm coming to work complaining about this boyfriend. No, I did not have a tour manager boyfriend when I was 6 years old.
I was say.
And so she was like, I just am curious. I know that you're in the movie, but have you ever actually read the book? And I had to sort of look away quickly. And I was like, eh. And so the next day she brought me a copy of Heartburn. And my God, what an incredible book. And I really, like, she had undone the shame of so many women around the world who had been cheated on by just saying like, hey, this is something that we all go through. And anyway, then I loved her even more. I mean, my God, I love Nora Ephron like crazy. I have this old email from her that says things we spoke about today. And it's the first document of Russian Doll in paper. It's just the email is called Things We Spoke About Today. You play a character named Nadia. She wears black clothes. She smokes too much. She has existential problems. She lives in the East Village in Alphabet City. She has a godmother named Ruth. Like, it was bananas. And I
wait,
found
so
that
how early on were you talking about this with her?
I guess, you know, Russian Doll had been this sort of, you know, it wasn't even Russian Doll yet. It was just this idea of, I guess, I've lived a life and I should do a show about it. So to me, it was always more of like an All That Jazz or Once Upon a Time in America, like this idea of, you know, somebody in an opium den or on their deathbed sort of looking back at a life. And it was took sort of like a decade for it to reach its final form. Obviously, Poehler and I had a failed show at NBC called Old Soul with Greta Lee and with Ellen Burstyn instead of Elizabeth Ashley playing Ruth. And so, you know, that failed first. And then Leslie Headland, who is one of my best friends, kind of came in. And it was Amy and I had been talking about what would the cable version of this be? And, you know, we really started to build what was going to become, you know, the real, like Amy and I had already been talking about a lot of things like Exterminating Angel or, yeah. No Exit or Choose Your Own Adventure, this idea of like, you know, a party that no matter who you chose to bring home that night, you know, 3 months later, you'd be stuck with yourself. You'd have like a couple of nights where you'd think you'd cracked it. And at the end, you'd still be stuck with self. And then it just began to really take shape.
Well, just okay. So this, I want to dive into all this, but just in the interest of chronology, which is what we try to do it in here, we want to come back to this. So Heartburn's 86. That's your first time in a movie. 10 years later, you're Woody Allen's daughter in Everyone Says I Love You. And this is literally, you said you'd been pulled out of yeshiva in order to do that movie. And that you were kind of, in hindsight, maybe you were a little, you were not realizing like he wasn't looking for a buddy. Is that the gist of it? Like you were pretty tight on that one.
Oh, are you talking about me and Woody?
Yeah.
So let's see. So now it's, Everyone Says I Love You. I'm his and Goldie Hawn's daughter. And I think in general, I'm not hip to the auditioning process. Like people later, like Kevin Corrigan would tell me about, oh, you don't know, like when you go in and you meet Woody, you don't talk. And, you know, you just, but I kind of came in there like, in rollerblades with like my long skirt from, I was going. So basically the deal was that my grandparents would only pay for things if it was, you know, religious or orthodox, but meantime, you know, like everybody was like a fucking cokehead and alcoholic. So it's a weird dichotomy where we're sort of playing this sort of two-faced game. And, so I come in there and I think at the time I was a real wake and bake stoner and something I don't do anymore because now I'm into tea tree toothpicks, which are really meeting my needs emotionally. And so I came in there and I remember that Woody was like, so how are you doing? And I launched into like a 40-minute monologue about like, you know, yeshiva's a mess. I'm in this Honors Talmud program, but like, who needs all the Aramaic? My parents got divorced with the tax evasion, da 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 da. And I'm like, what am I even doing? I'm in this long skirt. I don't even know. It's khaki. It was on sale at Banana Republic. I have three of them. I hate this skirt. I don't even know when I picked up rollerblading and so on and so on. And I guess he brought me back, like, you know, like four more times to, because he was confused that I was going to continue to be that person. And sure enough, that was, I mean, I would be like, you know, smoking pot out the window of the weird little office before coming in for the man. Then we would run the scenes and everything. And
I mean, it does sound like it would be his daughter, this kind of bundle of nervous energy, right? I mean, it makes sense.
And then I guess now I even have that Louise Lasser haircut all the time. Right. But, you know, I just, so then I guess we got there and I think then I was just, honestly, I think I was just really intimidated. Like I was number one on the call sheet and, but everybody was like a movie star. It was just Julia Roberts and Goldie Hawn. I remember I loved Alan Alda because he would talk to me about science. I was really tight with Natalie Portman and Gabby Hoffman and Lucas Haas because we were the kids. But I remember getting really pissed off at Ed Norton, who I've since become friends with again, because like Woody gave me direction one day and then like Ed turned to me and he was like, so what he's saying is, and I was like, excuse me? I was like, what part of, I was like, have you never seen Streetwise, the documentary, sir? I was like, baby Linda Manns understands me speaking to Inge. I'll take it first person, sir. And, but just everybody was such a big shot, Tim Roth, Drew Barrymore, like, and, I guess Tracy Ullman and Liv Tyler were in it, but they, I think they ended up not being in the final cut, but it was just a real bonanza. And I think I sort of like lost a measure of my personality on it. Like, I didn't really understand. I think I was just intimidated and scared, you know? It was really,
I mean, you're
like,
16, right? That's crazy.
Yeah, and maybe it was even 15, I think. 15, and it was sort of like, you know, in school, I'd been sort of this weird, like, outcast who was, they were very excited when I got this. I was like, right all at the same time, I'd been expelled for being the yeshiva's pot, like, pot dealer. And I'd taken, like, I discovered Nirvana, so I was wearing, like, black skin-tight clothes with, like, a push-up bra every day. So I was, like, technically covering my body parts, but in a very slutty way. And like high goth. And it was in elevators in Manhattan school. So, you know, you just reek of weed in the elevator. And I was on scholarship. So they had like all these reasons to get rid of me. And I was sort of a, like a bad influence kid. And so then I think when I went to this movie and all of a sudden everybody was so fancy, I was just, you know, I was just intimidated. And, like, I look back now and I remember like Woody would jump around in the scenes, like there'd be these 6-page scenes between father and daughter. And I was like still a child actor who came memorized and prepared, you know, like things that now I would see as such a joy in a way. But I think other people had a hard time. I think Julia Roberts had a really hard time. I remember she was like crying one day being like, he's really hard. And, she was great. I mean, she was fucking really, I don't think I'd ever seen anybody in my life who radiated that thing. It was like basking in someone's golden glow and so nice. And anyway, I do remember that at the end of the movie, like we're both dressed up as Groucho Marx and I was sort of like crying and we were hugging and he was like, it's okay. You did a good job. And I remember Gene Demanian later being like, I never understood why he didn't fire you. He loves firing. And it was just a trip. Like I honestly, like by the time I got to Slums of Beverly Hills with like Alan Arkin mm-hmm. and Tamara Jenkins and Marissa Tomei and Kevin Corrigan, Carl Reiner, Rita Moreno, Dave Krumholtz, like that was, I feel like in a way the first time I sort of understood in a way how to make a movie or something. I think that was the first, I was sort of, I don't know. Maybe I'd sort of been through the fire already. So I was relaxed enough to kind of lean in.
Well, and Sons of Beverly Hills, that's 2 years later. And you have said that coming out of that one, which was very well received. And basically you said if that was your one kind of like ingenue moment where people were wanting you to do all the different leading young teen kind of parts. Can you just give us an idea of what that moment was like? What were some of the things that you chose not to do, which you've mentioned some of them in the past, and I'm curious why you kind of resisted what seemed like they would have been probably nice paying, you know, cool gigs.
It's funny. I mean, I listened to Karina Longworth's podcast. You must remember this. I was, you know, listening to Polly Platt, Invisible Woman. And it's like, you know, all the times they offered her to be a director. I remember one of the things that came up around that time was like the Hanleys were big around that time. They were doing sort of Buffalo 66 and stuff like that. And there was some movie that like Harmony had passed on, and they sent it to me and they said, do you want to direct this movie? And I was like, no, this movie's crazy. And in a way, it's funny to think that that was like a path sort of diverged. I think about that sort of a lot now, like why I didn't just go for it then and sort of like make some mistake of a sort of teenager's movie and
or TV show, right?
Well, I don't know that TV was so much in the discussion at that point. Like for some reason, they were still very separate.
But wasn't there, I mean, I've heard about stuff and maybe it's BS, but like, you know, where I'm gonna, well, I mean, I heard you were offered Buffy and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Dawson's Creek, Blossom, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Like these are, I'm just curious. I'm not saying it was not like in some way it was like the wrong decision. I'm just curious why those things may not have appealed to you at that time.
Well, first of all, I didn't get offered all of them. Some of them I tried out for and didn't get, like Blossom and Sabrina the Teenage Witch and, you know, the Addams Family. There were so many I didn't get. Lorenzo's Oil, Regarding Henry. There were plenty. Cape Fear, Lolita. There's so many that I remember not getting. But yes, there was this moment where it was like the beginning of, I guess, the WB. I was very into Lenny Bruce. I used to wear this Lenny Bruce t-shirt that said truth is a four-letter word. And I had a fifth in my back pocket and I rolled into the WB and they were like, you know, here's our shows. We've got, you know, Dawson's Creek and Felicity and whatever, all these other ones. Which do you want to do? And I was like, have you guys, and I'm like morning drunk and like 17. And I'm like, have you guys seen Chinatown? And like, in fact, we haven't. I was like, so what if I was sort of like a PI, right? And you know, in black and white now you get shadow and light. And I'd have these slats on my office, you see, and I'd have a secretary out front and I get these cases and they were just, it was not a match. It was not, the best way I could put it is it was not meant to be. And I think I was very into the Deer Hunter at that time. Like I would run around like Didi Mao Du Mao Mei. I was like really, I was a teenager. I was an all the way teenager. And yet,
wasn't it around that same time though that you did agree to do, and people have to pay the bills. And I know you've said these are not your favorite of your movies, but I mean, a lot of people saw you in the first American Pie was 1999. And then there's a sequel in 2001 and 2012, but the second Scary Movie is in 2001. These are, you know, those are not Cassavetian projects.
I did really like Chris and Paul White's. I didn't understand the film because I had no frame of reference. I don't think I've ever understood a virginity picture, if I'm being honest. I just don't understand why there are so many of them. And like, why are people always running around me? I'm like, I'm a virgin. It's like, go have sex with someone, dude. Like, you know, let's jump to act two. I don't know what's happening. I thought that it was sort of a crazy movie. It was very suburban. I don't know. My point is here anyway. But I'm a Cheerleader was around then. I loved, yes. But I'm a Cheerleader. Clea DuVall, yes. Still my, you know, best friend. And I'm so tight with Jamie and Melanie Lynskey. And anyway, I loved it. Bud Cort, Mink Stole. And, so I'll tell you why I did Scary Movie. Scary Movie 2 came to me and I was like, what is it? First of all, actually, I just want to say that I love the Wayans brothers, like all together. I'm a big fan. And however, it was the opening of the movie and it was supposed to be me and Brando. So it was, that was the appeal. And then, of course, he showed up one day, got so sick and was replaced by James Woods. So I'm glad that we're touching today on all these people that are so popular in the zeitgeist in this moment.
Well, but wait a minute. Let's not gloss over. You did shoot a scene with Brando, right?
And I have VHS of it. I actually need to get it transferred because I get nervous that it...
Yeah, it could disintegrate.
It's pretty dark, though. I mean, he's like on an oxygen tank with an earpiece, and it's heavy.
What else is going on?
Oh, what do you want to hear? You want to hear about how he's holding my boobs, and he's you know, it's a lot
as
of,
scripted, or was that Brando method?
No, it's just that it's sort of like the whole scene is weird because I think I seem more like a prop than a person because I have all this prosthetic makeup on me, and the bed is doing this thing where it's supposed to be like a low rider, so it keeps moving. That's part of the gag, and but anyway, that was for sure why I was so excited to do it. I was like, I can't not work with Brando.
Right.
I actually think it maybe is his last thing. Well, I killed Brando. How else do you want me to...
It goes Brando all the way...
And I
Vivian Lee all- to Natasha Lyonne. okay, so now the fact that very shortly after that, I think you're in your early 20s, and you sort of stop being as visible for a little while. And I wonder, you've said that part of that was, I guess, things were getting a little heavier with your substance use and all of that. But was work thinning out, and that had something to do with you picking up the substance abuse, or did the substance abuse cause work to thin out for a little while?
So this is a chicken or the egg. First of all, thank you. I feel like you're being very polite about it. I think it was a real who's on first. I mean, I was so, I think my whole career and life in a way, I mean, and certainly Poker Face has, you know, been defined by like a real inability to tell a lie. So I don't think I was ever really trying to hide it from anyone. I think I was like, just sort of showing up places, just being this, you know, come as you are. And definitely I was getting a reputation. I remember my agent calling me like very upset. She was like, I saw a breakdown and it was for a Natasha Lyonne type because you're unhireable.
Oh, like, Jesus.
Baby, 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 those are the flakes. that's how it goes. You know, sometimes it chips her up and sometimes they're not. But certainly then the drugs were like serious enough that there was no way I could show up. Like there were definitely a few things. I remember I tried to show up, like Rob Zombie had written me a part in a movie and I was really excited and I just like, you know, physically couldn't make it. And it was so, that was sort of when I realized how dark it was, because I really badly wanted to be there for Rob. Like I loved him, and you know, we're friends again now, and that's nice. And I was tight with his wife Sherry, and I was like, oh right, I really am pretty far gone. And that's it. I mean, drugs are very real, especially if you're doing, you know, very real drugs.
Can I just ask? I mean, I don't know if it's something that's even knowable, but was there? Do you feel like you got into drugs because you were kind of rebelling against something, or is it just a predisposition, or what do you think brought that about?
Listen, I mean, I definitely like, you know, I saw it at home. I was raised to be a certain kind of way. I was like raised on a certain sort of sound of like this is what Led Zeppelin sounds like under the right conditions. And I think I had a real sort of romantic notion, you know, of like, you know, I'd watch something like, you know, Cassavetes Husbands or something and be like, ah, that's what it's about. Or, I don't know, just all of it, you know, The Shining, like they all felt in some way influenced by this deeper darkness and the same was true for like, you know, John Fante books or this book written by this guy, Jack Black, not our friend Jack Black, but this hobo, turn of the century hobo called You Can't Win. That was like William Burroughs' favorite book. And when William Burroughs was a guy, and, you know, they were all these sort of like characters and like, who the hell was Miles Davis and what was his trip? And I, you know, I think I was just very curious in a way about what was really going on that was making people make this kind of work. Like what was it all about? And it certainly did not feel to me like it was about, you know, American Pie at Universal Pictures. It just didn't. It just felt like that was a sort of a false bill of goods, and not even that it was sort of, you know, good or bad or neutral. It just sort of felt like not, you know, not heavy enough, not real enough. And, you know, it was like, well, gosh, how did they make Panic at Needle Park? Like, what was it like being on set of Raging Bull? I was just sort of curious about, I think, a different, darker, heavier thing. And so I think I just, there was sort of a romantic notion that was also a predisposition, that was also a learned behavior in the house. So it was sort of a perfect storm. And yeah, I think I was finding that, like, you know, showbiz as like a teenage actress was this very, you know, hollow man game. It was a real, you know, it was all about your outsides, and, you know, insides were just problematic for everybody. And like, wouldn't it be nice? Like, you know, you'd read scripts. I talked to some of my, like, I'm, you know, I love young people, you know, and the old. And but, you know, I talk to some of my young friends now, and they'll just be like, oh my God, these scripts I'm getting, it's just like the, you know, the teenage girl, but like her dad thinks she's kind of hot as she's walking around in her bra, and like she's going through puberty, and it's fucking disgusting. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of very weird shit that you are reading that just does not feel fully formed, or it feels almost like, you know, dangerous, and they want to keep you at a very low. Yeah, it's basically about girls growing boobs. That's pretty
well,
much
I mean, literally, that was the central, and not to say that it was a bad experience, but I mean, it did for a few of your few of your early parts that you're, you know, whether it's again, Slums of Beverly Hills is a great movie, but I mean, boobs, boobs are relevant to that part. And then the American Pie.
I mean, a lot of what that comes down to is like, you know, female lens and male gaze, right? So it's like the truth is that was Tamara Jenkins' personal story, and it's like handled comedically. It's not like,
no,
you know,
I get it.
Salacious of like, you know, whatever, like softcore for, you know, girls under the age of 16. Like, and I just think that, yeah, that was just, yeah, definitively not my bag. And I was already sort of like skewing much more. I think I was also, you know, pissed off. Like, what, like, you know, what would, you know, Pacino and Chris Walken and Eric Roberts and all those guys get to be doing? Or even if I would see something as dark as like Star 80 or something, I'd be like, I don't want the fucking Mariel Hemingway part. You know, like, I'm not saying that this, you know, Eric Roberts part is so seductive or anything. I mean, obviously it's a very problematic character, but I, just to say that it just felt like there was an imbalance of the ask repeatedly. And, so I was curious about, you know, how the other half lived, and if nothing else, to become a writer or a thinker.
Well, and yeah, I think it's notable that all the different references you've brought up that were appealing to you were pretty much the male characters right through, I guess, essentially with Poker Face. I mean, this is it's clearly influenced, right, by Columbo and Peter Falk and other, or each of these. There weren't too many female performers or parts that were models of what you wanted to do when you were coming up, right?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways there were. Like, I loved Jenna Rollins, and I loved Bette Davis, and I loved Barbara Stanwyck. And for some reason, I was really loved Jamie Lee Curtis in A Fish Called Wanda. But I loved Jessica Lange and Francis. But, you know, what I really loved was, like, Sylvester Stallone and Rocky and The Godfather and Scarface. And, yeah, like, so much of even my, you know, accent and sort of like the way I walk and talk is really just me stealing from them. And
is the accent actually, like, if you were just, you know, woken up in the middle of the night and somebody called you and you needed to speak or something, is this actually your accent?
Yeah, I think it is. It's sort of like sometimes if I get very heated, I do sound more formal. Like if I'm really trying to make a point about something that really matters to me and we have to, you know, like, you know, the break into act three is not going to make sense if we don't do this. And that's why, you know, so like if we don't stack the house correctly, we're going to be fucked. And all of a sudden I sound much more sort of academic almost or something, but I don't know that it's.
Did it originate as a, like, cause I've heard you say it didn't make life easier when you were, for instance, a adolescent actor where I think for some people they wanted you to maybe lose the accent, but was, so did it actually at some point just become your accent or how conscious was it?
Yeah. And I think also like, you know, I definitely am somebody who has, you know, anxiety or sort of is camera shy or stage fright. So I just think that, you know, in groups or something, it'll get more defined. You have to get me into a pretty, just like for whatever reason, it's like I'm a New Yorker. Like for sure, when I'm going to the deli or I'm getting in a taxi or, you know, like the plumber comes over, that's just how I talk naturally. So I definitely grew up talking like this. And I mean, my dad's a boxing promoter. So it was very sort of kind of encouraged in the house of like, this is the language, you know, and he's from Brooklyn. So there is a measure of that, but I don't know. I don't know how much is, I'm definitely going to try. I mean, now that there's Russian Doll and Poker Face, I really feel like, and even Orange is the New Black, I'm definitely, you know, my goals for the next few years are to really try and, you know, break out of this and see how far I can go. And I guess we'll find out together what my true capabilities are. I certainly like my, you know, my worst nightmare is staying stuck here. I just, I do think I really believe in naturalism and obviously like the long goodbye and, Elliot Gould is, you know, the Altman long goodbye is like such a huge touchstone for, Nadia and Russian Doll or for Charlie and Poker Face. And, or we would talk about California Split a lot with Poker Face, or, we would even talk a lot about like Gene Hackman and Night Moves and kind of like this sort of lazy back foot sort of middle-aged kind of character, Jeff Bridges, Big Lebowski, like really. And I would just say that Ryan is, I mean, he's just one of my favorite people of all time. He just knows his shit so well. He's like such a clean genius. And obviously, you know, we become friends because of Karina, his wife, who's just, I mean, a master. So she knows everything. And so, but I think, sometimes I don't even notice. Sometimes I don't even notice that I have an accent. And, I guess the only time I really got to fuck with it was like, I did this, Mike Lee play, 2000 years that, Scott Elliott directed in New York at the New Group. And that was with a British accent, but I didn't see anything that said like, and then, you know, in walks Stallone with this mess of an accent. Apparently I can do an accent. So, so that's promising.
Well, that play though, I know is important along with, I want to kind of talk about how this last decade or so, I don't know, the Leonissance of all the things that you've talked about, right? We've got Orange is the New Black was about a decade ago. Then of course, Russian Doll. I don't know if that's still going or if that's a period at the end of that sentence yet. But then we have, of course, now Poker Face. But basically, you said once in an interview, quote, and this is going back to the difficult, you know, the drug years, I guess, quote, I dropped out and nobody wanted me back, frankly. It was not like Robert Downey Jr. and everybody cared. Nobody cared, close quote. So how did that turn around? It seems like it might have been A, that Mike Lee play to some degree, but also I guess Jenji Cohen is finishing up Weeds and that's how you guys first cross paths?
Yeah, I just like I'm a real, you know, day playing working actor again who's just trying out for everything, getting rejected for most things. Chloe Sevigny is my best friend still. So she vouches for me to Scott Elliott at the New Group. That's how I get this Mike Lee job. And I guess sort of like theater led to theater led to theater. I feel like I sort of did like 3 years of off Broadway in various plays, including the Sam Gold play. Also this play called Blood from a Stone. And so I think I was really finding my legs there. And yeah, then I got this kind of call from Jenji that just felt like such a big deal, you know, like to come be in the finale of Weeds. And I guess she was probably already I Spying Me for Orange Is New Black.
But do you know what even put you on her radar? It's not like you were widely visible at that time. What do you think? Has she ever told you what made her think of you for Weeds? And then I guess goes pretty seamlessly from Weeds pretty shortly thereafter into Orange Is New Black.
I'm not sure. I mean, I wonder if some of it was maybe Jen Houston, who's like a wonderful casting director who had probably been coming, you know, through her office a lot, trying to get jobs that I wasn't getting. And, but I think Genji, I'm going to see Genji actually tomorrow night. And, you know, to hear her describe it, it was like, she was just somebody who remembered me and was just kind of like a fan and just wanted to work with me. But I was so grateful. Like I just, you know, and again, so it was sort of like this flip where sort of the first time that I was in this business, I didn't even, it was just kind of a moving train that I was sort of on. And then the second era of like Mike Lee and Genji and all that really, you know, and Amy Poehler, it really began this new era that was sort of really choosing it as a life's profession. And then of course, like, you know, by the time I got into really like writing, directing, producing, then it just sort of felt like just very much like a relaxing sort of exhale of, oh, right. This is, I'm in the right business now. Like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Evolution into becoming kind of a multi-hyphenate, as people say, I mean, you started out on Orange Is the New Black. Technically, I guess, I don't know how it was classified, you know, but for Emmy purposes, it was a guest actress, right? I mean, it was.
Oh, yeah. And it was it was like, you know, like $1,500 an episode or something. And it was, you know, you remember that Netflix was also, you know, we didn't know what it was. It was considered like a web series. So nobody was like that impressed when you got the job. And I think that for me on some level, I was sort of like, okay, so I was a junkie and now I'm being cast as a junkie. Like that doesn't seem like a huge leap, but I really needed the work. And yeah, it's crazy the evolution of like what ended up going on there. And I mean, I guess I would just say to the kids or whatever, you know, it takes a lot of work. Like you got to work really, really hard. I mean, I just worked like a dog.
Well, professionally, you essentially came back from the dead, right? You were not, when it was bad during the period when you were, you know, personally struggling, did it occur to you that it might not be possible to continue making a living in acting?
Oh yeah, I definitely was like, oh, maybe I'll become a drug counselor or something, or maybe I'll go back to school. I just like, I had no idea how I was going to make a living. And yeah, it was like, no agency wanted to represent me. Nobody wanted to hire me. It was just like, and I think I also like, you know, I was like so sick and underweight from drugs. And then I like, you know, gain weight because I'm like, and also I had like a heart condition that wasn't helping. And so I think like, you know, especially like that was not something that people had any, they just don't care about. Like they, you know, unless like a woman kind of comes back and she's like, ta-da, or you're kind of Robert Downey Jr., there's not a lot of sort of like empathy or space for like really wanting to nurture that artist back into their, you know, greatest self. It's really a tough road, you know. I think the other thing that's pretty gnarly about it is I think that there's always this expectation for like a 28-day journey, maybe just because of the title of that movie or something. And, you know, I think most people at this point have some either firsthand, you know, relationship to like addiction or, you know, proxy relationship to it by a family member or friend or something. And it's, you know, the truth is it's a very big undertaking. It's not like, and within a month, we'll be back, baby. It's a big game. It's a lot of years. So, I mean, all told, obviously, at this point, I'm very grateful for that particular journey because it just, it's sort of like it made me like go off and sort of like read and write and think in this way that I think a lot of my contemporaries were like, you know, busy getting their picture taken and being on that ride. So sort of like by the time I got back to it, I had a real point of view, I guess, for lack of a better term.
And we can just note the experience with Orange is the New Black, 7 seasons. You got your first Emmy nomination for the show. You direct an episode for the first time in the 7th and final season. You're, I guess, for the first time on a show with mostly almost all other women. And it's sort of from that, it's like a new lease on life, right? When you're coming out of Orange is the New Black, that, I guess, even in the midst of Orange is the New Black is when that first bantering around of ideas with Amy Poehler was happening, where, right, with the old soul.
It was like, I had never been sort of a regular on Orange. I'd always been like a year-to-year renewal. And so at 1 year, Amy and I went off to try to do this NBC show. And then, so I basically left the show. And when it didn't get picked up, I remember calling Jenji and begging for my job back. And she was like, I don't know. Jenji's always been so, so great with me. She was like, listen, I need you to do this movie for me like 6 months of the year, and whatever you do with the rest of your time is none of my business. And if you want to work on having your own show, I support you in doing that. And just show up to work and be here at my show and we'll figure it out. And she was very I think her and Nora and Amy all were sort of seeing something in me that I couldn't quite see yet, which was that I had a lot of story to tell inside of me, and that they wanted me to tell it kind of more than even I wanted to. I just sort of wanted to I'm a little bit of a, I'm a bit of a character actor. I like hiding behind a little. I'm a little shy basically. And I don't really know how to throw your shoulders back and take that photo, babe. It's just not my vibe, kind of.
But also, your timing is impeccable, because prior to basically your, run of the last few years, there wasn't much of a market for shows centered around people who were the, more the character actor type person, right? That's a fairly new development in television, right? Where you have outsider voices, outsider stories. I mean, Russian Doll and probably Poker Face, I don't know, how likely would those have been to exist if the exact same circumstances had come along just a few years earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that is, it's sort of like the time catches up to itself, or maybe they would exist, but they would have boys or something. We don't really want, rumply ladies. I'm a real Rumpelstiltskin character, let's be honest. I'm a bit of a Muppet. And that really only became a trend later.
You made it cool.
Rumpel. I'm making it a trend. And so, I had to bring the Muppets front and center and say, these Muppets are hot. These Muppets are smoking. These Muppets have problems. These Muppets are solving crimes. These Muppets are dying and coming back to life. There's fucking time travel trains. You understand the Muppets? And somebody had to do that, Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I guess it was right place, right time.
So we've talked about that, the seeds of Russian Doll. Just if anyone is listening who hasn't yet taken the dive, season one essentially is, you've said, basically a meditation on mortality. Season two, maybe more about the nature of time itself. I think the reductive comparisons are like Groundhog Day and stuff. I don't think you particularly like that, nor are they apt, because there's plenty of references, but I'm not sure those are the most apt ones. But the point is, season one, for your own, this is your thing that's like your baby in every way. How nice was it where that actually gets embraced to the extent, forget that it's, on Netflix. At this time, Netflix is now a thing we know about, unlike when you started with Orange is the New Black. But producing, writing, and acting Emmy nominations for season one, would you have ever imagined when you started out on that's where it was heading?
No, not at all. And, I don't mind when it's kind of like season one is Groundhog Day, season two is Quantum Leap. I mean, it's fine. It's fun. It's who cares? Yeah. I mean, they're both so insane, really, that it's incredible that they're on the air at all. You know, and I do have a dream of like a Fire Walk With Me dream. Well, that's concerned, but that's besides the point. I got a lot to do right now. I mean, my main priority is to try to, like, you know, direct a feature over here before that kind of stuff. But I was not expecting it. I don't think they were expecting it. I think the show was like a real under the radar thing. I think we had to fight really hard. I think that once they started seeing cuts, they started to believe in it. But I think it took everybody by surprise. And more than anything, I think for me, it was like this odd revelation that sort of being more, sort of like telling more of the truth was not alienating in some way, that like somehow that was okay, that was legal, that was not something to be ashamed of, and that there was in some way that this was going to be alleviating people of their shame, whether it was like, you know, I guess, you know, season one is really about being self-destructive. Season two is like, you know, parents with untreated mental illness. It's kind of like, you know, these were things that were kind of universal thematics that could potentially, I mean, ultimately, I always see it the same way, which is, you know, we live and we die. I think people forget that really a lot. I guess it's the nature of ambition or existence is we have to be in constant denial of that. I'm somebody who's, you know, keenly aware of that at all times, meaning which funny about, you know, getting all those nominations, man, so we're still going to die. And it's like
Woody's daughter for sure. That's
yeah, but it feels so good. You know what I mean? Like you just, because you work so hard and it's really, you're doing these like 18-hour days, you're sleeping 3 hours a day. I'm just like fucking doing pushups, listening to George Harrison to try to become a better person while you're sort of staying strong. It's really, there's like no way out. And they're tough and they're scary, you know? And, poker face. It's like, we're in the middle of Newburgh. It's like the weather is always changing. There's nobody around. There's no real, you know, cast, or there's always new directors. There's, you know, multiple ADs and cinematographers. So it's like, you're always the welcoming committee of this. So it's very lonely out there. And you got like 60 pages a week to memorize, and, you know, and you want to do a good job. And Ryan is brilliant and I love him. So it's like, I want to, you know, do a good job for him. And it's kind of like, you know, all of it is ultimately sort of like lonely, heavy, heady work when you're really in it. And yet it is really, you know, it's so worth it. I just don't know what else to do with myself. It's kind of like a musician being like, you know, I guess stop playing music or something. I wouldn't know really. I would just sort of sit here, I guess. So the awards are, I guess, in that sense of like they're this kind of affirmation around it, but they're also this really dangerous thing where it kind of becomes like a litmus test of, you know, so was this thing worthy, a worthy endeavor or not? And I think that if you look back, I'm sure you know the statistics better than I do, of like so many, many, many of the things that we reference now as the ultimate sort of like templates of greatness were at their time utterly ignored, you know? And
in TV, that's The Wire, that's, we can keep going. But, and just because some of those things weren't there for season two doesn't mean that season two was any less great than season one or whatever.
Yeah,
but
I think also, like, you know, there is a sort of like trick to that, which is you've got to really, you know, play this mind game with yourself where either you got to like buy in, right? Like if you're going to believe this, then you got to believe that. But in fact, like I see something and I'm like, I'm so blown away by what we made. I'm so proud of what we made. And it is the thing that we set out to and wanted to make, you know? And I think it's something that, you know, everyone was so proud of. Netflix was so proud of, and the crew was so proud of, and the actors are so proud of. And it's like, you know, it's like you're coming out of a pandemic. There's a million fucking shows. And it's just, there are so many worthy things. It's like, it's very solipsistic to make it all about sort of like, you know, self and what do I get? And
But we do have to note, season two, though, we have to give credit where it's due. Not only this, I mean, it seemed like you had plenty of jobs the first season. Season two, you also became the showrunner, right? I mean,
it was also sort of like somewhat de facto. We did sort of, there was like a bit of a whatever, it's just life's too short to get into it right now. But, you know, it was a sort of, de facto choice. And I remember by the end, Genji was actually the one that was just like, well, describe what you're doing. You may as well just do this job because you're doing it anyway. And, you know, Leslie's already off on Star Wars. And it's a, but, you know, I think more to the point, what I really like learned on it is huge. I mean, like to be able to get these sort of like, you know, education like thrown in the fire is sweeping. And I can't believe the work we got. And I'm like, fucking show looks bananas. I mean, when I look at the seasons back to back, you know, I'm so proud that Ulo was also nominated in season two for cinematography. Like, we're just really pushing the limits of what we can say these shows can be. I think it's also they get sort of hairy, frankly, and like all the categorization of, you know, comedy and drama and what's what. I think that becomes, you know, inevitably like season two is a much deeper dive and it is much, you know, headier material, and that is on purpose. So I think it's a real, you know, it's a long way of saying I personally believe it'll actually stand the test of time quite beautifully, just as somebody who really knows my movie lineage. I think, you know, anything radical is really the name of the game. And it's like, if you don't take big swings when you can, then I'm not really sure what you're doing at a certain point. Then you're just sort of like, you know, I guess just trying to win at life. And as I've clearly stated, there's no such thing. We're all going to go out the same way, Kyle.
Well, so is that project done, or is there more Russian Doll in the future?
I mean, I think that there's potentially more in the future, but I think it's going to take some time. I think that, like, you know, it's just like a crazy time in this business. I think for me, my priority right now is directing a feature. Yeah. Only that's a priority for me over season three of Russian Doll. I think also, you know, now we're on the kind of poker face train. I think weirdly, to me, Russian Doll would have done better to be considered a limited series, because I think that's always how we envisioned it. And it actually, the second season is very similar to what was actually pitched, which was like, she goes, you know, she becomes her mother. And, but I just think that the nature of like COVID and the 4-year split and so what I think is great is obviously I'm sort of gotten into the business of playing these kind of ageless characters who could be whatever. I don't think that it would be a problem for Nadia to be like, you know, 60 arriving on the scene, having some sort of like New Yorkers problems. So I don't know that it's like my next order of business, but I don't think that sort of philosophically Russian Doll is something that I'll ever be done with. So I think I'll always, you know, life finds a way, and so does death, my friend. So I think it'll sort of find its right time. I just think, I mean, really, the lesson for me of like that show is just how much I, you know, like my heart and soul is in directing in such a beautiful way. I mean, even getting to direct Nick Nolte and Cherry Jones and Poker Face and, this Orpheus Syndrome, which, you know, I got to co-write with Alice Jew, who's one of the writers from Russian Doll. It was really like, even just more, every time I do it, I'm like, oh, right, this is the thing that really makes me feel 360 happy.
And that really that took off in season two, right, of Russian Doll, where it's 7 episodes, you wrote 4, directed 3, then we go to Poker Face, and that, I guess, I don't know the numbers exactly, the breakdown, but I mean, that's not... I guess is of those three activities, acting, writing, and directing, how would you, you don't have to kind of pick and choose, but out of curiosity, like what gives you the most satisfaction?
Well, for sure. What I think I love about directing so much is that it's so collaborative and it's so alive. So it's like, you're really, you're just like hyper present in the moment, and you have to be, like you have to be the captain on deck. And sort of, I feel like it's the area where most clearly like my defects become assets in a way that I am very like, and I go to sleep and I sort of feel like that was an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. I think that there's, you know, I really love producing, because I think it's very fun to kind of almost like the puzzles of it, sort of like connecting the dots and making all the connections and seeing other people's work come to life makes me really happy. You know, like what's very hard about acting and writing is they both involve a lot of like lonely homework. You just have to do the homework. So in some ways, like they're not that different of like, you've really got to get into this hyper-focused mind state to do them. And, but just sort of like once they're complete, the satisfaction is immense. Like the idea that you can really turn over a script or that you can really like play out the scene. It's just so, you know, crazy that you have to do so much, you know, quiet work at home to get them done. So, you know, but I in so many ways feel so lucky that like I found myself in this sort of, you know, rickety sort of circuitous way in this kind of, you know, business. Cause I really do love it. It's really like, you know, my thing.
Well, just to close this out, I want to come back to the story you started to set up at the beginning with how, you know, you and Ryan, who is like the new Agatha Christie of this, between all his glass onion and all of that. But you guys come together for Poker Face. This, you know, it's basically, I think, if you could classify it as, I've seen people call it a anthology series in the way that, anyway, the response has been great, not only to your performance, but the fact that, you know, it's become a showcase for so many great actors who I think are maybe in some cases, you know, well, let me quote, here's what the New Yorker, the way they put it, quote, "It feels like the star giving her fellow character actors the chance to be the Natasha Lyonne of their respective episodes," close quote, where I guess basically talking about like 10 years ago where you were guest starring in Orange is the New Black, popping up, and you know, you have less screen time to you better deliver. You surround yourself in this show with so many great people of such different backgrounds and levels of experience and ages and all of that. And I guess just what you've made of the, you know, who you've made it with, and also the response to the show, which I feel like has been pretty tremendous.
Yeah, I mean, it has been pretty exciting that people have really fallen for it. I hadn't heard that from the New Yorker. That's very funny. I mean, it's been incredible. Like Janixa Bravo directed the finale and Clea DuVall is in it. And I mean, those are like two of my tightest people in the world. And obviously Chloe and, you know, Ryan, like gets Noah back. I'm actually tight with Tim Blake Nelson. And, you know, it really, Dash Polanco, who's also in Russian Doll and Orange is the New Black and Poker Face. I mean, it's sort of like, I think I love keeping it in the family in this way of like, it's some sort of, you know, Cassavetes, Mike Lee, like idea of a rotating cast of characters or something that I think I feel very, I just feels like everybody can kind of, knows the rules of the game and can push a little bit further with it. And it's been very moving to see, you know, this response. Like, I love that people are so into it. And I just love working with Ryan. I love, like, you know, we get to like text each other all day, playing crossword puzzles on set to kind of kill time together. We just really have a very special dynamic. And I think that, you know, that is what was so wild about after the first season of Russian Doll. I was like, yes, there was a lot of fanfare. And yes, like all this, you know, like awards chaos and stuff, but really nobody was sort of showing up with like sort of pen to paper and saying, hey, let's make something. And Ryan was the only one that really said, I really want to make something with you. And we would sit and we would have all these meetings and we'd, you know, talk about Fat City and whatever else. And then like 4 months later, he actually, you know, gave me a script. And he was the guy that actually kind of, you know, had a plan for, we're going to make something. And I just am so moved by that. Like I really love him for that, because also, yeah, I mean, we sort of touched on in a lot of ways that there weren't always people really willing to like kind of, you know, yeah, I accept that I'm a bit of an oddball or an outsider, but it's also, I don't know, sometimes it's weird for me because I'm like, well, I'm not that fucking weird. And and so it's just like, you know, but the options are not always as wide as one would think. You know, like sometimes you know, you'll hear people complain about like a, you know, Meryl Streep or something, like, well, she's the greatest actress of the generation. You'll hear other actresses say, well, that's because she gets to choose from the greatest scripts, you know, like and you know, obviously I certainly don't mean that as any, of course, Meryl Streep is brilliant, but I'm just saying that there's something to be said for getting to work with incredible material. And that's really what Ryan, you know, provided here. And I love Charlie, and I've always loved, you know, like Peter Falk. I love the idea. I just love the idea of being sort of like a back foot person. And, you know, after playing Nadia for a bunch of years, like Nadia is much more kind of Lou Reed sort of nihilistic in a way, that to sort of play in the desert sun, kind of open that sort of Jeff Bridges energy, was really very fun for me. Of somebody who actually like likes people and just kind of gets curious and sniffs over here a while.
and it seems like that might be closer. Like, which of these characters is she? Is it just, am I wrong to assume or to kind of take away that there is she pretty close to you? You seem pretty.
Oh. I would say I actually don't think I'm very Nadia or very Nikki or very Charlie. I just I'm a little more like, it's hard to describe, I guess. I just am a little like introvert thinky, I guess, in a way. Like maybe I can sort of like put on their costumes well out in the world, sort of like move through life. Like I've figured out almost like, you know, Mae West or something, that this is like my drag character that works for me and that people understand and find palatable. But yeah, I would say that the real me is probably a third thing. I'm just a little bit, you know, cerebral to a fault. I don't know that I'm winning anything by it. I think it's probably only causing suffering, but I'm a little bit more almost, you know, like academic or philosophical or something, my nature. Like I require a lot of, you know, private thinking time, basically. Like if I don't get, like, I don't know what that means for how I'm wired, but if I don't get like a lot of time to just like, you know, sit and think and stare at the wall and that kind of thing, like something, you know, it's hard for me to sort of like put on that sort of like Mae West cloak and that sort of swagger and attitude. That said, I'm also really a New Yorker. So I've learned how to move through the world in a way that kind of has a certain sense of street smarts that says like don't fuck with me, like you know. So right. I do think in that sense maybe I'm similar to them. The other similarity, I guess, is that, you know, like what's most similar to Nikki is I really, yeah, there is like this great, you know, like love for the people around her, like, you know, Kate Mulgrew and Yael Stone, of like she really wants to sort of take care of them and is getting through with jokes. And what's really true with Nadia is she is this sort of like, you know, existential person who's really trying to kind of find this sort of root cause of this PTSD and get to the bottom of it. And like knows that she can only do it with a sort of chosen family, that that's the only safe way to really go all the way in to the belly of the beast. And she's sort of like not scared of being a sort of like, almost like her own science project, or I guess because she's like a video game coder, she can sort of see the world in through a very specific, you know, lens. And as scared of the information as she is, she wants it, you know. She's like a real thinker and sort of psychedelic by nature in some way. And I guess, and has a lot of recovery in her also ultimately. I think that, for Charlie, she just loves the underdog and like can't stand for injustice. And I would say that's really what, you know, so I'm just saying in terms of things that are similar between me and these characters that are really like the touchstones that I use to kind of make them my own. It's like, for me, I just can't stand by it. Like if I'm seeing some sort of, you know, we're trying to enact some crazy law of like, we're a bunch of people and we're going to decide who can get gay married. I'm like, are you mentally ill? Why do you think you get to have a choice? Who the fuck are you? You don't get to have an opinion. You're just like another, you know, another schmo. You're another bozo on the bus. People don't get to dictate other people's human rights. That's not how this world works. Like, and yet it is. So I do think that Charlie really has that very much in common of like this deep need to sort of like tell the truth, even when it'll get her in trouble, of just, you know, to make sure that she's looking out for, you know, for the right guy.
Right. Well, I get such a kick out of everything you do. I really appreciate you doing this, and can't wait to see what's next. I hope that feature sounds exciting. So, I guess get on it. Right? Yeah.
Scott, I'm getting on it. You're gonna watch King of New York.
And yes, we both have our marching orders.
Yes, and then we'll both watch King of Comedy just for fun. And
absolutely,
that's our plan.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. I really appreciate it. Take
care. See you later.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.